Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. With just 6 days left in 2017, we wanted to spend some time today looking back at the biggest international news stories of the year. And to do that, we're joined from London by Christiane Amanpour, CNN anchor and chief international correspondent and host of the new show Amanpour on PBS. She's with us on Skype. Christiane, welcome back.
Good to be with you at the end of a very turbulent year.
Well, and as you look back at all of the international stories from 2017, what stands out to you as the most important?
Look, the Trump effect has been the most important, not only in the United States, but around the world. That, coupled with a wave of populism that certainly the Western democracies are dealing with, has sort of exacerbated a global crisis. I like to call it the world on the edge of a nervous breakdown, because what's happening is that the order that has been protected and led by the United States for 70 years since the end of World War II, otherwise known as the liberal world economic order, is beginning to show fractures caused by President Trump's America First policy and a gradual withdrawal from not only a leadership role, but also from great big areas like the Pacific, like even the Middle East, I might add, and certainly Europe. So there is a lot to discuss about what this will mean going forward in 2018.
Well, who is stepping into the void if there is a leadership vacuum because of what's happened in the United States?
Well, I think for certain, I have spoken to a lot of experts, not just current world leaders and secretaries of state or foreign ministers, as you call them over here, people involved in economies, finance, climate negotiations, and especially in security and intelligence fields. And they point to, first and foremost, a big withdrawal in a certain way from the Pacific area. And the reason they say this is because they see China jumping in to occupy a vacuum that's being created, a vacuum of leadership, whether it is on climate, whether it's even on trade, free trade. I was told that President Trump pulling out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was a gift that was given to China. And that even though President Trump and the economic nationalists may believe America first and all of that, this kind of withdrawal benefits America, from our side of the pond and in the Pacific, they say, well, no, when you try to have bilateral agreements with every country in the world, that is much less efficient, much less beneficial to the American worker than multilateral agreements, whereby you just get a better deal out of the trade and finance and all the rest of it. So there's that. And that coupled with the question, do we want to live in a China-led world? Is that what we want to be doing as democracies, as people who've followed the so-called liberal world economic and democratic order for the last 70 years? So there's that. Then there's the question of what does that mean if the United States starts to exacerbate its relationship with China, as you saw in President Trump's national security review that was announced earlier in December? If he does that, if there is a threat of, let's say, a trade war, protectionism, tariffs on China, let's just say some of that comes to pass, how does one get China to help and cooperate with one of the most severe disruptions that could come in 2018, and that is some kind of conflict with North Korea?
Well, actually, the Chinese president came out at the Party Congress this year and said that he wanted China to take center stage in the world. You asked Sui Tang Kai, who's the Chinese ambassador to the U.S., for a reaction to the recent U.S. National Security Strategy document, which described China as a threat to the U.S. and whose dominance risks diminishing the sovereignty of many states in the Indo-Pacific. And here's what he said.
China is not seeking global dominance. We believe in today's world, all countries are confronted with a lot of common challenges, and we do share growing common interests. So what is important for us is to form a wide-based global partnership to respond to the common challenges.
Do you buy that, Christiane Amanpour, that China is not seeking global dominance?
Well, look, they may say that, and we've all been talking about the great sort of ancient paradigm of Sparta and Athens, you know, a rising power trying its best not to confront the existing established power head on, because that can only lead to tears. But having said that, President Xi Jinping started the year, right before even President Trump's inauguration, with a speech at Davos. You know, he'd never been to Davos before. It's very rare to see a Chinese president of the only major communist country remaining come to the, you know, capitalist democratic talking shop known as Davos and say, we're ready to step in, whether it's climate, whether it's, you know, global trade, whatever it might be. He gave a warning there against protectionism. Then, as you say, ends his year in November, around the time that President Trump makes his landmark visit to Asia, by wrapping up this party congress with unprecedented powers in his hands, unknown since the days of Mao Zedong. And he says there again, much more clearly, that if there is a need for leadership, look to us, we will help. And given the fact that here's the crazy thing, as the former head of MI6 told me, Europe has more in common in certain areas these days, certain policy areas, with China than it does with the United States. Right. This is crazy. This is crazy that on climate, on free trade, on things like that, you know, Europe could be drawn more into the China sphere if the United States starts to pull back on those issues. And this is how the world is slowly being reshaped in this year.
Well, let's talk about Europe, and let's talk about what's been happening where you are in London and Brexit, as the UK starts this process of getting out of the European Union. Do you think that there is regret in Britain that vote happened the way that it did? And what about what it means for Europe going forward?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of buyer's remorse, but depending on what poll you look at on what particular day. And the fact of the matter is that while there is still a very dedicated and quite prominent but small group of people led by the former Prime Minister Tony Blair, the former leader of the Liberal Democrats and previous Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg and others who want to stay in Europe and want to persuade the British people that being out of the EU, out of the single market, out of the customs union is a very bad thing for Britain and will affect our economy here. Despite that, the majority of people anyway seem to believe that it's going to happen and that we had better get on with it and make as good a deal as we can out of it. But I will again issue some caveats. Again, not mine, but those of the experts. Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, came out very, very prominently saying that what we predicted for the British economy in 2016, around the time, even before the referendum happened, is beginning to show through on the high street and in business right now, that there is a slowing down of the economy and that will have its inevitable repercussion and effects going on as this negotiation carries on. The former head, as I say, of MI6 told me that Britain will be less powerful, less important on a military intelligence and foreign policy level going forward. It is still a serious country. It still has its seat at the UN Security Council. It's still a prominent member of NATO, and it wants to play a major role in the world. But inevitably, it will be diminished, at least in the short run. So I think people who hope for the best are looking for a very long term, and knowing that Britain has always been a country that has punched above its weight. And of course, it has been up until now the financial capital of the world. You know, they're hoping that that will see us through.
One more thing I have to ask you about, and that is that there have been a number of major terrorist attacks this year, several in London, where you are, but also in Manchester, England, the attack at the Ariana Grande concert, and in many other places. And at the same time, we've seen ISIS lose some of its territory in Iraq and Syria. Where do you see ISIS as it ends the year in 2017?
On the back foot, which does not mean they're down and out, which doesn't mean that there'll be copycatism, which doesn't mean that there won't be crazy people like in Australia, people with mental health issues driving cars into pedestrians. But in general, the rationale for ISIS was the caliphate. And the caliphate has now, if you look at territory, has been, you know, decimated. And therefore, that gives a chance for, but it only will work if there's decent policy and reconstruction and all the rest of it on the ground. President Trump continued the Obama administration's policy of hammering ISIS, and General Mattis was very clear when he took over as defense secretary that this was going to happen and this was the policy, and it seems to have paid dividends. Yes, I covered all the terrorist attacks here in Great Britain over the last year, but I will say the country has ended the year still on a strong foot. It hasn't been cowed. And I would just say that, you know, as we end yet another year where social media has been dominant, remember, social media thrives on hate. Social media thrives on dividing us. And I really hope that 2018 is a year in which we consign social media to only the relevant and useful stuff that it can do for us and quit looking at it as a political barometer or a vehicle for activism, because it is not.
That's Christiane Amanpour, a CNN anchor and chief international correspondent, and now in the public media world, host of Amanpour on PBS. Christiane, thank you so much and Happy New Year.
Thank you so much to you and all your listeners.
It was a breakout year for country music star Brett Young. His debut studio album came out in February. His single, In Case You Didn't Know, peaked at number 2 for 16 consecutive weeks on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. He was also nominated for a CMA Award in the New Artist of the Year category. I spoke with him back in August, and I started by asking him about his hit song, In Case You Didn't Know. Even though So tell us what this song is about, first of all.
Well, I think most guys can relate to being bad at expressing their feelings. And this one came about kind of funny for us because it was originally a conversation that we were having about one of the other writers, Trent Tomlinson, and something that him and his mom had when he was a kid, where every time he'd leave the house, she'd stop him on his way out the door and say, "Hey, Trent, in case you didn't know, I love you." We thought, how sweet is that, right? But also, we probably don't want to write a song about your mom. So let's try to figure out how we're going to twist that. And I think that was the common thread that we could all kind of relate to, was, you know, being men and being bad at expressing our feelings. And you know, for the most part, it's not even that we don't want to say the things that women need to hear. We're just bad at it, and we're aware of that.
So, well, you're the one singing it. I mean, have you had that experience?
You know, as a songwriter, I think I tend to be a little bit more on the, like, emotional side as far as men go. But yeah, I do. I think that men and women are wired very differently, and you know, you can very innocently and unintentionally, you know, omit things that you know the other party needs to hear. And yeah, I'm sure I've been on that end of it.
We've read that you didn't necessarily think you would be a musician. You were more into baseball. You were a pitcher in college. What happened? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, no, baseball was a big part of most of my life. But I think growing up in the church and listening to music and playing music, just kind of because that's what you did growing up in church and in Christian school, it was always kind of a part of me. But baseball was the biggest part of me. And it took, you know, a career-ending elbow injury in college for me to have to kind of, you know, put life back in focus and figure out what it was that was going to make me happy. And it was when I hurt myself, there's a large amount of depression that goes along with, you know, a career-ending injury like that when you think it's going to be your whole life. And music, just at the very beginning of it all, became kind of an outlet for that.
So even before that, were you a fan of country music?
I was. The first country song that ever really pulled me into the genre was Tim McGraw, "Don't Take the Girl." The only reason I even heard that is because I have an older sister, and I was being an annoying little brother who had the front seat and control of the radio one day. And she didn't like country music at the time. And the only way, you know, I could bother her, because she was busy back there kicking the back of my chair to bother me, was to blast some country radio. And I thought I was doing it to bother her, but the joke was on me, because Don't Take the Girl came on and I fell in love. And I think that was like 93. And so I've been a country music fan ever since.
I go through country music phases here and there. And of course, every time I ever go to Nashville, I've got to be playing country music in the car. But you're from California.
Yeah, you know, I was one of the first one of my friends to find country music. And I got a little bit made fun of for it, you know, back then. But it was interesting to be, you know, going to the beach and surfing every day and then driving home and listening to country music. But that was kind of my jam.
Now, you have your guitar with you.
I do.
And can you play something for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of my favorite songs off of this record is the last one. And I think it's maybe one of the saddest songs on the record, too. So I apologize for that. But it's a song called Mercy.
Mercy, why you gotta show up looking so good just to hurt me? And why you wanna stop this whole damn world from turning? Mercy, why you hanging on so tight if this ain't working? And why you wanna stop this flame if it's still burning? It's still burning. So if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make it. Or make this fast. If you ever love me, have mercy. If you go out tonight and get drunk and lonely, wind up home alone, please don't call me and say you miss me, no. So if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make this fast. If you ever love me, have mercy. Whoa, whoa, have mercy. If you're gonna break my heart, just break it. If you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. Oh, if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make it. Make this fast. If you ever love me, if you ever love me, have mercy. Oh, have mercy, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy.
Wow. Thank you so much. Brett Young doing Mercy right there. Now, why is that the last song on the album?
You know, I always feel like as a music consumer, I always want that, like, that kind of slow, stripped down personal song to close out the record just when I'm the one listening. And so we put it there on purpose for that reason. But also, that song wasn't going to make the record. We had 11 songs already completely picked out. We had put out originally a 6-song EP. And when we went to finish the record, we found out that there's just a thing with iTunes where when you put out the rest of the record, it has to be at least twice as long as the EP. And it was like a very happy accident because in the 11th hour, I got to sneak my favorite song onto the record because of a technicality. And so it was not only the last one to make the record. Also, I just wanted to put that really personal song, that stripped down one at the end.
I noticed you got a Get Drunk reference in there. Is that a rule in country music that there has to be some reference to beer or getting drunk?
You know, that seems to be everywhere, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
I realize in country music, we probably are the quickest to talk about that. But I think, you know, in heartbreak, that, I think that's pretty universal in terms of in life, you know? And so I think country's really comfortable to say it, but I think everybody can relate.
Well, you've also said that you want to make music that parents and kids can both listen to, that's mature without being offensive. Why do you think that's so important?
I just decided, regardless of what, you know, what it was that I did for a living, if I ever was in the public eye, that I wanted to be one of those people that, you know, and specifically with music, where, you know, a mom might have a 13-year-old daughter and wants to go to a country music show, but doesn't have to leave her daughter at home because she's uncomfortable about the content. You know, I just never understood why lines had to be blurred in order to get messages across.
Do you remember the first show that you went to?
I do. My very first concert ever was Boys to Men and Mariah Carey.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was Boys to Men was and still are some of my favorite singers.
Huh. You sound nothing like Boys to Men.
No, I certainly don't.
Do you try to take anything from them?
You know, I do think that there's, you know, in my house growing up, my parents were big fans of soul music, you know, so I listened to a lot of, you know, Smokey Robinson or, you know, Gary Puckett and the Union Gap or, you know, Sam Cooke and things like that. And some of those have spilled over into my style of singing.
Let me ask you one more question. I mean, your song, in case you didn't know, is now right up at the top of the Billboard country charts. What's been the most unbelievable moment for you of all of this success you've had?
You know, for me, the coolest thing is to have a song, not only that you perform as an artist and that's on your record and that you've sent to radio, but a song that you wrote as well, to have that sung back to you when you're on stage. And the coolest time that's happened was when I got to go back and play my hometown. You know, a couple months back, we played the Hollywood Bowl. And that was a huge bucket list venue for me.
It's a great venue. It's
just incredible. I grew up going to concerts there. And so to walk out as the first of three and have it be full was already incredible. But then to have all my friends and family and my hometown crowd singing one of my songs back to me, I think that was the coolest experience I've had so far. I would be lying if I said
that I could live this life without you, even though. That's Brett Young. His new self-titled album is out now. He's also on tour. You can learn more at hereandnow.org. Brett Young, great pleasure having you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is seeking a fourth term next year, and yesterday, Russia's Election Commission barred his main rival, Alexei Navalny, from the ballot. Joining us now is the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, why is Navalny being barred?
Well, formally, because he has a criminal conviction. He was judged guilty of fraud, and because of that, and because 10 years has not expired since the end of that sentence, he's not eligible, according to the law, to run for president. Now, he has two arguments against that. First of all, and most importantly, he says that the charges were always political and they were always intended to bar him from running for president. And secondly, he argues that the Constitution says that as he's not in a prison, he's not actually behind bars, then he should be allowed to run. But essentially, the Electoral Commission dismissed all of those arguments and said that according to the law, he can't run.
And how is he reacting to that?
Well, he made a very passionate speech in the Electoral Commission defending his rights and a real sort of feisty to and fro with the head of the Electoral Commission, very personal, in fact, on both sides. But in the end, it made no difference. So he called what he had threatened before, which is a mass boycott of the vote. He's essentially going to mobilize all of his supporters and the volunteers to go out onto the streets and to campaign for people not to take part in the election. And his point is that Vladimir Putin is now pretty much the uncontested contender in this vote, although, of course, there are other people on the ballot. So his point is that Mr. Putin needs a high turnout to look legitimate. And he says, Mr. Navalny says, this vote is not legitimate without him running. So therefore, they want to chip away at that turnout. They want it to be as low as possible. And they want Mr. Putin to look like this election is utterly, and his re-election is utterly invalid.
And Putin says there may be something illegal about a boycott of the election.
Well, his spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, was asked about that today, and he said that the Electoral Commission had acted in accordance with the law and that the call for a boycott needed to be scrupulously studied, as he put it. And I have to say his tone of voice was such that it sounded like a veiled threat, or certainly a hint of possible difficulties to come, even more difficulties to come for Alexei Navalny if he does persist, which he will, with this boycott call. You know, I think the big question is how big a backing he can muster. I think he's also going to call street protests. He's already talked about that. So it really depends how many people he can bring out onto the street, whether or not he can bring any real pressure to bear on the Kremlin. And I think at this point, they've done their sort of electoral maths and their political maths, and they've decided that they think the threat and the risk is small enough that they can contain it, and Mr. Putin can still run and be elected as the uncontested and unrivaled leader of Russia.
What does public opinion say about Putin right now in Russia? Does he have strong approval ratings?
He does. I mean, Mr. Navalny and other critical voices here would say, well, you know, he would have, wouldn't he, in a country where the state media is utterly controlled. But generally speaking, I think, you know, just anecdotally even, it's fair to say that he is popular. You know, his message is one that resonates with a lot of Russians, this message of Russia being returning to the global stage as a strong power. They like his foreign policy. They like the return of Crimea in 2014. And so things like that still play well here with many people. But of course, there are critics. There are people like Alexei Navalny. And, you know, by barring Mr. Navalny from the vote, it is looking a little bit like the Kremlin didn't want him to have a platform to voice those very personal and very direct criticisms and to perhaps dint that support across the country.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford joining us from Moscow. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
The stock market got off to a rough start today, dragged down in part by Apple, which announced a disappointing sales forecast for the iPhone X, one of the biggest products of the year from Silicon Valley. Joining us to look back at 2017 in tech is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is executive editor of Recode and host of the podcast Recode Decode. Kara, welcome. And let's start with Uber. Just last week, the European Union's highest court declared Uber a taxi service, which means stronger regulations for the company. But it has been a tough year for Uber and its former CEO, Travis Kalanick, starting back in January with the protest hashtag delete Uber. Remind us what happened.
Well, what happened was, in that case, it wasn't really Uber's fault. There were issues around the immigration ban that President Trump was attempting to put into place. And so it seemed there was a protest at one of the airports, I think JFK, and it seemed as if Uber was taking advantage of the situation by jacking prices, essentially. And they actually weren't, but they were trying to get cars there to get people there. Mm-hmm. But Travis had such a bad record in general of abusing consumers, drivers, and their own employees, nobody believed them. And so they started this Delete Uber campaign. And he was also on the board of one of the president's business boards, which have since been disbanded because everybody quit them. It just was it was the beginning of a really bad year for Travis Kalanick. Much of it self-inflicted, almost all of it. Pretty.
What
much.
About for Uber? Does Uber end the year in a stronger or weaker position than it started?
Well, you know, it's a question. It's a big question because they have a new CEO. They had almost constant dramatic upheaval in the boardroom, a dysfunctional board, a dysfunctional management system. And of course, it was all set off by Susan Fowler, who was an engineer there, who wrote a really devastating blog post about what it was like to work at Uber as a woman, which painted a really ugly picture of the company.
And do you think that they've made changes that will fix that image problem for Uber?
Well, they fired the CEO, so that was one move, and the founder. He's one of the founders. And he's still on the board, though, and a major shareholder. And so we'll see. You know, the new CEO, Dara, is really he's from Expedia. He was the CEO of Expedia, and he's very adult, and he's very mature. So we'll see if he can do it. But a lot of people feel that the idea of sort of the pirates of Uber's era, which grew them to the large size they have been at, is over.
What about more broadly in Silicon Valley, not just Uber, but the issue of sexual harassment? How did that unfold this last year in the tech sector?
Well, again, it came out of the Uber, the Susan Fowler blog post, right, which sort of put focus on that idea of that women are treated badly at companies. Now, Uber is just the quintessence of that. But as the year progressed, people began to uncover and finally write about a lot of the abuses, including among some venture capitalists, and behaviors, and women just around the whole Me Too idea began to talk about those behaviors. I think every single company was impacted. We actually wrote a story very early in the year about someone Uber had hired from Google who had been the subject of a sexual harassment investigation, and Uber didn't know that when they hired him. And I pointed it out to them, actually, and they fired him. They ended up firing him. So, you know, it's been a long year of, I mean, I think it's called the reckoning or whatever you want to call it. But it's certainly washed through tech, and it's not over for sure.
Has it been different, though, in the tech world than in Hollywood or on Wall Street or in Washington?
Different in that it's the same vile behaviors. And, you know, it was started off a long time ago by the Ellen Pao trial, you know, when people were focused on gender discrimination. And the numbers are still terrible, not just for women, but in age and with people of color. The diversity numbers are still, you know, staggeringly white and male.
Much of the news this year has been dominated by President Trump's first year in office. But tied into that is Russian interference in U.S. elections, which includes the use of social media. Russian ads and posts may have reached 126 million users through Facebook alone. How big a deal was this for companies that had to deal with that issue, like Facebook, Twitter, and Google?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, they were slow to understand how important this issue was. But I think we can call this the year of the weaponization of social media and the resulting impact on the election, which I think will never be known, probably. But it certainly, you know, we had another government interfere in our election using tools that we created in this country, which is kind of ironic in many ways. And then the companies in question not having control of their platforms enough to understand what had been perpetrated upon them, the propaganda, the persistent favoritism toward Trump. So it was, you know, there's never – I don't think they're ever going to figure out exactly what the level of incursion was, but it's essentially a hacking of democracy.
One of my favorite stories of the year in any sector was the announcement from Amazon that it would start looking for the site of its second headquarters, basically every city in America, almost every city.
Stunt. It was a perfect stunt,
and they all wanted it. What is it about this? I mean, did that surprise you what the reaction was to that?
You know, it's exciting that they're coming up with another headquarters somewhere, you know, and they're trying to I think Jeff Bezos is trying to get ahead of the idea of Amazon as this scary monster that's taking it over and killing retailers all across the country. And so I think they wanted to get ahead of it by doing this thing, which I think every city in America sent them a video saying, please come to our city. It's almost like sports teams, right? It reminds you of that. That said, you know, they will bring a lot of interesting jobs to whatever city they pick.
What city are they going to pick, Kara?
I don't know. I'm going with Pittsburgh. With Pittsburgh for me. That's my choice. And then maybe Nashville. I mean, one of the problems Amazon has is they certainly have to locate somewhere that's within the range of their employee base, which is quite tolerant and much more liberal. And so they're not going to want to locate in a state where they, you know, pass transgender bathroom laws. I mean, they'll just have to leave because there'll be a backlash among their own employees. And so it's going to be an interesting choice, you know, and that's it goes around the responsibility of tech companies to the society at large, which I think is one of the biggest stories, is how much of a responsibility does tech have for its inventions and the impact of its inventions on the rest of the body politic, essentially.
We had a lot of hacking this year, like 100 million plus Americans affected by various hacks. Is that the new normal, do you think?
It's really disturbing. It's certainly disturbing. I mean, the idea that everything is online, your whole life is online. And again, it's a responsibility of these tech companies. I mean, Equifax is really one of the real villains this year in terms of how they behaved around this hacking. They had a patch to fix it. They didn't fix it. They weren't paying attention to the way people, you know, use how important privacy is and how important it is for them to protect your privacy. They were incredibly careless, and it resulted in this hacking. I think the thing is realize all the things you can do to protect your information and the fact that you're not really that protected.
One more thing we have to talk about, and that is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin. I knew it.
I mean, it's just been going through
Ethereum.
The roof.
You know, it's not. There's Litecoin.
Right.
There's a lot of them. There's a couple of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think drove Bitcoin this year? Why is it doing so well?
Well, I think insecurity, economic insecurity, and there's a lot of stuff going on in China being bought. You know, it's a global phenomena. And so it's not really, it's also speculative. I mean, a lot of people are comparing it to the early internet and that everybody thought the early internet was sort of a scam and then it wasn't, except everyone knew what the internet was for. I think Bitcoin doesn't have a use right now. Consumers that are buying it don't use it to buy things or to buy houses or real estate or all the different ideas around blockchain technology of how it's going to change the way we transact. And I think that's a huge idea. That is an enormous idea. It's just a question whether Bitcoin's going to be the currency. And then the other one's Ethereum, which the founder is purporting that it's a platform to do transactions on in the blockchain technology. And then there's Litecoin. So,
right.
You know, directionally, it's correct, this idea of changing currency, changing transactions, how we interact. I'm not so sure that, you know, but people made a lot of money. So what am I? I actually bought Bitcoin a long, long time ago, and I've lost it. Like, that's the problem. It's not like a bank account. Like, I mean, it is, but it's a bank account. I forgot. I did a story on it for whenever it started. Bought a couple of Bitcoin for a couple $100 each, or I think they were $600.
Well, you'd be and now, so rich right now if you had kept
I
that.
Am. I just can't find them. I think I have 10 Bitcoin somewhere, and I just was so careless with them that I didn't think that was that big a deal. And I can't find them where I put them. I don't know. So.
Well,
I am rich.
I saw a tweet by a reporter who said that they had done a story a few years ago about Bitcoin and took a group of people out to a sushi dinner. And she said, now that dinner would be $99,000.
So, yeah, I know. It's crazy. Oops. It's, you know, it's one of those FOMA stories. It's the biggest FOMA story. I should have bought it. Even earlier this year, it's up 8,000%, some number.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of friends who were into it a long time ago, and they are very wealthy. I would personally sell it immediately if I were them, but they want to hold it. These people, Bitcoin people want to hold this stuff. They
think
it's going to the
moon. They think it's going to go to $100,000 or $500,000.
Well, if it's too good to be true, I don't know. That doesn't change year to year, I don't think.
That's Kara Swisher, who is executive editor at Recode. Kara, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel wants to build a high-speed rail line linking downtown Chicago to O'Hare International Airport. It's a plan the former mayor, Richard Daley, wasn't able to carry through. The city is accepting proposals from private developers, and Elon Musk's The Boring Company is one of those that wants to fund, build, and operate it. Joining us now is Joe Sweeterman, who is a professor in the School for Public Service at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also on the board of the Midwest High Speed Rail Association. Joe, welcome to Here and Now.
Good day.
And what is Chicago looking for in the proposals for this project?
Well, it's exciting. There's been a lot of talk over the years about, you know, fast service to O'Hare Airport. And the mayor, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, is pushing it in a pretty big way now. He's putting some political capital behind it and calling for about a three-month period for proposals and qualifications, you know, for potential bidders to make this project happen.
And Elon Musk has come forward. Who else has?
You know, I've been watching this town for a long time, but this is a new one. We have reports of private talks between the mayor and Elon Musk. According to the Chinese are looking for demonstration projects to show their technical abilities. And there's just been a big consulting study to show that this could be done using some of our existing tracks without enormous amounts of money. So there's a flicker of hope in this, and that's raising some excitement.
Is there a big demand for this service? I'm thinking I'm coming to Chicago next week, making a connection at O'Hare, and I would like to come into the city, although who knows how long it'll take to get in and get out based on the traffic. But are a lot of people asking for a high-speed train into Chicago?
Well, that's a really good question, and certainly everybody sees that global cities around the world have good links to the airport. You just look around the globe and see Chicago ranking in those top 15, top 10, some polls, you know, should have service commensurate with that. There's a more difficult question, though. Is there a large, large body of people willing to pay, you know, taxi cab fare type prices to get from downtown to the airport? And, you know, the evidence is mixed on that. Toronto had some difficulty doing that. Other cities like London have had real good success. So there's a bit of a if you build it, will they come question. And so that's led to a bigger debate. If we do this, should it be more than just getting people from downtown to the airport? Should it be, you know, sort of a broader mobility corridor that, you know, does lots of things, get people from all over the Midwest to O'Hare, perhaps? And that's raised a lot of discussion.
Why was Mayor Daley unable to accomplish this?
Well, the mayor was thinking big in his last years, and you know, as a mayor, and he had his eyes set on the Olympic bid and put lots of energy behind that, but also had made O'Hare kind of his pet project in some ways. And so when he proposed this, it was really quite glamorous. There was going to be a check-in of baggage downtown. We're going to build passing tracks on our blue line, our rapid transit route to get trains O'Hare fast, even belt a station downtown. And then, you know, kind of the wheels came off, no pun intended, that we lost the Olympic bid, the recession hit, there were, you know, severe difficulties for the city. So all that got mothballed, and we didn't know if it ever see the light of day again. But sure enough, it's back in a big way.
Well, in this time, the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, wants to have a private developer build this train. Are there downsides to that in your view?
Well, there are downsides, and the biggest thing is there a risk that the existing transit system would get shortchanged if you built this? And then there's been some pushback already by people saying it's just not possible to put all this emotional energy, all this political focus on a high-quality link to the airport while our existing system is, you know, really aging. If you've been on the L, you know it's a legacy system that you know, it's been partially modernized, but we also have parts that pretty much date back almost 100 years. And so there's that pushback. A lot of us, you know, look at this and we think, you know, getting lots of different people to the airport from different routes would really be exciting, like we see in Europe. We have Amtrak trains that, you know, stop at Union Station downtown in our city, and they could go to the airport. We have people that want to get across town, and that's really difficult in our city because everything kind of stops in the loop. And if you had a really high-quality corridor, and some people calling that crossrail to get people across town, this could become the spine for that.
So do you think this is going to happen? And if so, when?
Well, all of us, you know, look at this, and when the mayor says no public funding, no taxpayer dollars, you know he's tying a hand behind his back. And to get this done, the city's going to have to be out there, you know, taking some risks. And a lot of us think that's worth it. I'm one of them. But at the same time, we know that, you know, the world's changing. We have new technologies like the thing Elon Musk is proposing with kind of the mini Hyperloop that he's contemplating. We just don't know. Could it be built as inexpensively as some of the new estimates that he proclaims are true? And if it is true, you know, we're going to see lots of things like this around the country. You know, but we're all quietly skeptical at the same time. I think we're pleased that the city is stepping to the plate, pushing itself out of its comfort zone, proposing something like this, seeing what comes back, and giving it a shot.
That's Joe Sweeterman, who's a professor in the School for Public Service at DePaul University in Chicago. Joe, thank you.
Thank you much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.